produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today, House approves increased student searches. Yesterday, just 25 members of the U.S. House of Representatives in attendance at the time passed the controversial Student and Teacher Safety Act of 2006 via a voice vote. No representative called for a roll call vote on the issue. The bill is not law and will require the Senate to pass a similar measure before the end of the current legislative session. As passed yesterday, the bill would require schools who receive federal funding to have a program in place to search large groups of students in school on the suspicion that just a single student brought an illicit substance to school. This would require police to carry out searches similar to the high-profile Goose Creek, South Carolina case, in which an entire school student population was searched with dogs and with students held at gunpoint. The Goose Creek action found no illicit drugs. The vote yesterday came despite well-voiced opposition by thousands of individual American students, mobilized by SSDP, or Students for Sensible Drug Policy, and statements made by politicians and parent-teacher groups. In a letter to an SSDP supporter, Representative Mike Honda, a Democrat of California, wrote, quote, "As a former teacher and principal, as well as a member of the Democratic Task Force on Education, I believe it is crucial to make schools as safe as possible for our children. However, I believe this can be done without invading the rights of our students." Close quote. In addition to some members of Congress, the National Parent Teachers Association, the American Federation of Teachers, the American Association of School Administrators, and the National School Boards Association all issued statements opposing the legislation. More information can be found at schoolsnotprisons.com. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit NORML.org. Today in our Health and Wellness Wednesday, we have an extended interview with Paul Armentano. Paul compiled a report covering 6 years of research regarding cannabis. Normal is the only source of this type of easy-to-use information. We have links to the new Normal report, Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis and Cannabinoids, at normalaudiostash.com. This report can be the starting point for a discussion with physicians or politicians and can help us all understand the true medical benefits of marijuana. Last week, the Normal Foundation released a comprehensive report on the clinical research regarding cannabis. And joining us today is the author of that report and Normal's senior policy analyst, Paul Armentano. Paul, welcome back to the Audio Stash today.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
Paul, this report, Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis and Cannabinoids, is really something that's become essential to all Americans because there's simply a lot of information. Over 700 reports in the first half of 2006 alone. Paul, what do you attribute this uptick in research to?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the first thing that one notices when they do a review of the published literature regarding the therapeutic use of cannabinoids is that, in fact, there is an awful lot of research taking place right now. And if we were to go back 10, 20, 30 years ago, you really couldn't say that. One of the first things that jumps out at you when you begin reviewing the literature is that if you go back to, say, the mid-1980s and you do a keyword search on PubMed or Medline, any one of these search engines that looks at the numerous medical and scientific journals that are out there, and you type in cannabinoids or you type in THC or marijuana, if you go back 10, 15 years, you maybe get a couple hundred citations for articles published over the course of that year. If you enter those same keywords in today, you get close to 1,000 published articles coming out on an annual basis, many of them, in fact, the majority of them, exploring the therapeutic use of cannabinoids.
And these studies are not on acne or something like that, but on very serious life-threatening conditions. And regarding cancer and Alzheimer's, these diseases, they're some of the most concerning conditions in America.
Sure. In fact, one of the ways that the research today seems to stand in contrast to much of the research that was done 25 and 30 years ago is that investigators today are often looking at the question of whether cannabinoids actually moderate disease progression, whether they in fact could save the progression of certain types of potentially life-threatening diseases like Alzheimer's, like MS. That's actually quite a bit different than the research that was taking place 20, 30 years ago. Not in any way to downplay the importance of that research, but as many people are familiar with the research in the 70s and 80s, we were often talking about potential symptomatic relief. For instance, if somebody was suffering from cancer and undergoing chemotherapy and were suffering from the nausea associated with that chemotherapy, could inhaling marijuana help offset the nausea that patient would feel? And we all know the answer is yes. But that is an example of looking at whether cannabinoids can help treat symptoms of the disease. Where this research has really moved forward, and this is something that's really only happened over the last couple of years, is that many scientists recognize that, in fact, cannabinoids can bring about symptomatic relief for a whole host of ailments, whether we're talking about spasticity associated with MS or we're talking about the sort of appetite loss that's associated with HIV medications or that sort of thing. They've moved on from asking those questions to asking these much more significant, in many ways broader questions. Can marijuana actually help change the pattern of serious diseases? And in some of their most preliminary findings, they're finding out that yes, indeed, cannabinoids can in fact do that.
Now, Paul, I love the way you and the designers have presented this report online, but many of these conditions have multiple references and studies cited. How are so many different researchers coming to the same types of research regarding cannabinoids?
Well, I think what is happening is there are certain areas of research where cannabinoids seem to hold the most potential. And not surprisingly, researchers are focusing on those areas. Two of them seem to be addressing this family of diseases that would fall into the category of either autoimmune diseases or neurological diseases. Autoimmune diseases would include things like diabetes, MS. Certain neurological diseases would include diseases like Alzheimer's, ALS. Those are two areas where it does appear that cannabinoids, and in particular the endocannabinoid regulatory system, do seem to play a role. And many scientists believe that by better understanding the role of the endocannabinoid system and better understanding the role of cannabinoids, that they can actually manipulate the progression of these two families of diseases. And, of course, the other area scientists are looking quite a bit at is the potential anti-cancer effects of cannabinoids.
And, Paul, when we talk about this current cancer research, you mentioned before the earlier trials with smoked whole plant cannabis. This current research, though, it's with isolated cannabinoids injected directly into cells.
That's true, particularly when we're talking about studies on the potential anti-cancer properties of cannabinoids. In almost every case, we are looking at either animal studies where the oftentimes synthetic cannabinoids are administered directly into the animal, or we're looking at studies at particular cancerous cell lines that are being studied in a petri dish. To date, there is only one study that I am aware of that would indeed be a pilot clinical trial where actual humans who were suffering from a form of brain cancer were administered cannabinoid agents, and it was studied to determine, or it was determined that, in fact, the cannabinoids did help to reduce the size of the brain tumors in these patients. But aside from that, most of that research is limited to the preclinical stages.
Paul, how can Americans who have these conditions listed here, such as diabetes, sleep apnea, or ALS, how can regular people become involved in the clinical trials that might take place?
You know, that's actually a very good question. It's a question I'm asked quite a bit. You know, unfortunately, in this country, the answer is most likely they're not going to be part of a clinical trial. One of the frustrating things for me compiling this research, and I would imagine for most individuals who read this report, is when they begin to look at the citations and they look at the names of the authors on these citations and they look at the universities where this research is taking place, they will very quickly begin to notice a trend that these studies aren't taking place in this country. They're taking place in Europe. They're taking place sometimes in Israel. They're taking place in Canada. They're very rarely taking place in the U.S. There are a handful of clinical trials taking place in California due to an appropriation that the state of California made several years ago now, and there is some preclinical animal trials going on in the United States, but of course for patients suffering from these ailments who would like to be part of a clinical trial, you know, that preclinical work is not going to help or benefit them. I would like to say that for patients suffering from any of these diseases, there is a possibility they could get in a clinical trial, but unfortunately, unless a person lives in California and unless they suffer from particularly multiple sclerosis or some other chronic pain condition, the truth is, at this time, there are no clinical trials taking place in the United States for individuals who suffer from conditions outside of those, you know, limited indications. That's not to say that elsewhere in the world these trials aren't taking place, but unfortunately in the U.S., they really aren't at the moment.
And how about these international studies? How could an American participate in one taking place in Canada, perhaps?
Canada has a track record almost as poor as the United States when it comes to engaging in actual human trials investigating the potential health benefits of marijuana. Their government does a song and dance that rivals our government when it comes to promising funding for trials and not delivering, when it comes to promising funding for trials and not delivering the funding. Canada's been playing a game with its seriously ill patients up there for a number of years as well now. So unfortunately, it wouldn't be as simple an answer as potentially getting into a Canadian trial, because while Health Canada has talked the talk on this issue for many years, they have not walked the walk, and with the political trend in that country and Parliament swinging further and further to the right in the past few months, it would seem even less likely that in the future any sort of trials are going to take place up there.
So as Americans looking at this data and these reports, and perhaps wishing to use this as a starting point for a discussion with some elected officials. Paul, having gone through all this data, what are some of the best learning points here for politicians?
Well, clearly, you know, reports such as these, and off the top of my head, I believe there's something like 159 footnotes, maybe 130 to 140 separate preclinical and clinical trials are cited, and this is simply over the last 6 years. And by all means, this is not necessarily meant to be comprehensive of the entire body of clinical literature on the therapeutic use of cannabinoids published over the last 6 years, because these were studies specific to 15 chosen disease indications. But what it clearly shows to a legislator, to a physician, to whomever, is that this idea that there is no published or no scientific evidence of the medical use of marijuana is completely false. In fact, there has got to be more published evidence on the therapeutic use of cannabinoids at the moment than almost any other substance out there. So clearly, that point needs to be made. The other point that really needs to be made, and it's one I stressed earlier, is this argument that for many disease indications, we are not simply talking about something that either masks symptoms or provides temporary symptom management. We are actually talking about an agent that potentially could slow or in some cases even stop the progression of very serious diseases, and we're talking about serious diseases where there currently are no accepted medications to do so.
When we talk about some of the specifics and these very deadly conditions that cannabinoids show promise really treating, why isn't there more outcry, more public outcry for greater research into these promising cannabinoid therapies?
You know, I think many people are probably unaware of much of this material. You know, it wouldn't be surprising, particularly when we're talking about material that's often conducted by researchers in foreign countries. It's often published in medical journals. They may not be American medical journals. They may be European medical journals. I do believe that in the coming years, this sort of information will be better vetted among scientists and among doctors. And certainly the hope would be that doctors and their constituencies in these particular diseases will be an outcry from that audience to demand more research in these areas, and obviously to demand a relaxation of the law to allow this sort of research to take place more easily and to allow the patients who suffer from these diseases, if they so choose to or if their doctor recommends it, to have access to cannabinoids.
Also, Paul, a number of these studies were conducted or funded by some big names in the pharmaceutical industry, including Scripps Research. Do you think those big drug companies might be seeing dollar signs in cannabinoids?
It's certainly possible. It's hard to say where this research will go. It's not surprising that some of this would be backed by larger pharmaceutical companies for the simple reason that oftentimes it is very expensive to conduct this kind of research, and without that kind of private financial backing, the research simply won't get done. But, you know, it's clear with if one is to look at, say, the recent approval in the EU of Ribonabant, or also known as Acomplia, which is the cannabinoid antagonist or the cannabinoid blocking agent, that there are some pharmaceutical industries that clearly do have a financial incentive to conduct this research, because they do have the hopes of bringing to market certain cannabinoid pharmaceutical drugs. It's also, though, not surprising that with the discovery and the better understanding of the endocannabinoid regulatory system, this idea that there is a system of cannabinoid receptors in various parts of the body that essentially maintain a balance throughout the biological system and seem to regulate so many pivotal functions like appetite and reproduction and mood and bone density and motor coordination that you're going to have investigators studying how that system works and whether that system can be manipulated by some sort of synthetic agents that eventually they will probably try to market.
Paul, this is a spectacular report, and it really is a tremendous amount of information. I know you will graciously take questions about all this. What's the best way for folks to ask you questions?
They can certainly email me at paul@normal.org. And I would like to say that one of the reasons I put together this report, it was really in response to the years of emails and phone calls I have gotten from patients, many of whom are suffering from the diseases that I highlighted in this report, who were really looking for some sort of objective summary of the research that they could take to their physician. In many cases, these were patients who had a long relationship with their physician, who may have been using marijuana but didn't want to tell their physician, or who may have spoken to their physician about it and their physician was somewhat skeptical and asked them for more information. And the idea of this report was that patients could bring this to their doctors, they could present it to their doctors could review it, and that would begin this discussion that needs to take place between the patients suffering from these diseases and the doctors who specialize in treating these patients, many of whom, as you noted earlier, are actually unaware that this this scientific evidence is actually out there.
Paul Armentano is the author of the New Normal Report, Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis and Cannabinoids, a review of the scientific literature 2000 to 2006. We have links to it at normalaudio-com. Next up today, it's time for our regular segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch joins us each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is on Normal's advisory board. He's the author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and is associate professor of psychology at State University of New York. Dr. Earlywine has a brand new book out, The Politics of Pot. We have links to Dr. Earlywine's books at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, thanks again for joining us here today on the Audio Stash.
Always a pleasure to be on Audio Stash.
Thanks again for joining us here today, Mitch. It's been a big week for arrests. On Monday, the FBI Uniform Crime Report was out, and then Willie Nelson is cited for possession in Louisiana. Let's talk about the psychology of the arrest. What happens to a human being in this type of police encounter?
I think it's easy for each of us to imagine, oh, we'd handle it so well, but in fact, this is a really big life stressor. I think what blindsides a lot of folks is they think at worst they're going to be arrested for simple possession, but often small things turn into big things once you've got law enforcement involved. I have a friend in Oklahoma who was cited for possession but happened to have a number of little baggies around his house, and they tried to pin an intention to distribute charge on him as well. Many a medical user has certain cannabis for one symptom and another kind of cannabis for another symptom, for example. Well, that to you looks like a good way to keep your medicine separated, but to law enforcement that looks like intention to distribute because you have a bunch of different baggies for different things. To them that seems like you've got a bunch of sales that are going to come later in the future. And I think people don't anticipate this and end up really disappointed and disgusted when what should be a really minor thing turns into a very major, very expensive thing.
So, Mitch, getting nervous or afraid in this type of situation, this is a completely natural and common reaction.
Absolutely. In fact, when you start looking at some of the stress reports that people have, arrest is right up there with things like very intense illness and even, an illness in your spouse. These sorts of stressors are actually very comparable. I think the other aspect of it that we often ignore is the finances. It can be extremely expensive just to handle a single possession arrest. And if we could move to, you know, a format of just decriminalization, just where you had a ticket and you went and paid it, that would be such a nice step in the right direction, saving government time, saving the time of law enforcement, of prosecutors, of police officers. And, you know, I can't help but think, gee, here's a plant that's essentially harmless. we haven't committed a harm to any other person, and yet here I'm going to have to pay a fine for owning a plant. It just rubs me the wrong way. It seems a real sad use of a government and its penalties for its own citizens.
Mitch, in your new book, Pot Politics, you talk about the costs of prohibition. Is arresting 700,000 people around America for simple possession actually preventing any marijuana use in the country?
It's a hard thing to address without actually changing the laws in the same place. But when you start comparing cities that are comparable with different cannabis policies. So I have a wonderful chapter by Craig Raineman and Peter Cohen in the book that says, here's San Francisco and here's Amsterdam. They're comparable in size, they're comparable in attitude, and they're comparable in the demographics, the ages of the people and things like that. But one has cannabis prohibition and one has more lax cannabis laws. And sure enough, the negative consequences of cannabis use are worse in San Francisco, where people can actually get busted for it. So the connection to hard drugs is much bigger, in part because cannabis is an illicit drug. You get exposed to that whole illicit market. Whereas in Amsterdam, folks who use cannabis do not go on and use hard drugs at the same rate as the folks who did in San Francisco. And you can go on and see this is a policy that has run its course. I understand that not everybody wants to smoke marijuana. That's super. But do we have to penalize people who do want to, particularly when they're using it responsibly? When I get into this argument, people say, well, marijuana will lead to these other horrible things. In fact, the data don't support that. But often those horrible other things are already illegal. If you think marijuana is going to increase aggression, for example, which obviously you wouldn't if you've ever smoked any, but aggression is already illegal. We don't need to draw this wild law to prevent something that isn't even likely to happen. It's just not a good use of our resources.
And the actual arrest is part of a broader health problem, our American prison population, a problem that has some pretty disturbing racial factors about it. You know, Mitch, how much do we spend on keeping pot smokers in jail?
I mean, it's astounding. My last estimates suggest that, depending on the prison, folks are spending about $22,000 a year to stay in jail, when we don't even spend that much to educate our own children per year. So I mean, that's pretty frightening thought. But when you think about, too, the racial bias is really distressing. And we've had data since 1981 suggesting that minorities are overrepresented in marijuana-related arrests. And when I confront my family members in law enforcement about this, they say, well, minority members are more likely to do their marijuana deals out in public. Caucasians are more likely to go in private. Well, if that's the case, and we need everybody to understand you shouldn't do marijuana deals out in public. But more importantly, it suggests that there's a strange bias going on with the way these laws are enforced, and we just don't want to have a country where that's the case. I would hate to think that anyone related to me, any of my loved ones, is going to be a target for arrest simply because of the color of the skin, the length of their hair, the way they talk, any of that. It's just not a way to enforce laws about crime.
And Mitch, how about the law enforcement personnel themselves? How do they view this?
In fact, when you talk to someone like Jack Cole, who's at Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, they find this a complete waste of their time when they could be working to battle violent crime like rape and murder and assault, to suddenly have to go take somebody down and get them fingerprinted because they're smoking a joint. Is just not the kind of country we want to live in. And so if you want to keep it criminalized, that's your prerogative. But what if that person could just write a ticket and say, here's your traffic ticket, here's your little violation for smoking pot in public, go pay it and be gone. And then we can keep those law enforcement officers on the street preventing the crimes that really matter. Or, God forbid, we say, you know what, there's no public consumption. Legalize and tax. Anybody who consumes in public gets this ticket. Otherwise, go home and enjoy yourself.
Mitch, I want to thank you for taking time again today to join us here on the Audio Stash.
Thanks again, Chris.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine is on Normal's advisory board and is the editor of the new book, Pot Politics, The Cost of Prohibition. We have links to it at normalaudiostash.com. Dr. Mitch Earlywine joins us each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash, and we have an archive of our conversations at normalaudiostash.com. This has been Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to podshow.com for all the great pod-safe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.